On this episode of Skeptico.
And he's the first guy to say, okay, let's put a meditator up. We'll set up the classic double slit experiment with a little photon beam. Let's see if a meditator can affect that photon beam in the double slit experiment. And again, an astounding result. I mean, a statistically overwhelming result that, yes, human consciousness collapses the wave function.
Dean Radin is a good friend of mine. He is simply one of the most creative people we have in our field. But I'm sad to report his idea of consciousness and wave functions are just demonstrably inconsistent with 80 years worth of experiment and theory. It's just simply not the case.
I take, for example, and this is going to relate right back into your work in Stargate, but the near-death experience science. I mean, there, it's kind of game over. Because now we have the brain out of the equation. The brain is
No. Absolutely not. I've just been engaged in a huge debate over this issue of near-death experiences, arguing with my colleagues that that is hard evidence for survival of bodily death. First off, there's nobody that has had a near-death experience who is in fact dead. That's a different category.
Not true.
Yes, it meets,
not
meets,
true. If we were going meets, to, if we were going to answer that question,
I've read the literature in detail and just finished reading a book about that by one of the biggest proponents, sir.
Stay with us for Skeptico.
Welcome to Skeptico, where we explore controversial science and spirituality with leading researchers, thinkers, and their critics. Of course, as you know, I always say the same thing at the beginning. I say controversial science, but primarily what this show has dealt with is consciousness and this battle over the idea of whether consciousness, your minute-by-minute experience, is more than just your brain. And of course, that's important because if it is, and it is because we've shown it over and over again, but if it is, then it more or less overturns science in some pretty important ways. Now, for a long time, it was always assumed that psi effects, ESP, telepathy, precognition, that kind of stuff, that if that was proven true, then the materialists, the mind equals brain folks, would have to admit that they're wrong. Because the assertion being made, and I always point to Daniel Dennett, the philosopher who was famous back in the day when the atheists were kind of running the world, of saying consciousness is an illusion. And along with that was this idea that consciousness can do no work. Consciousness being this non-physical thing that's going on up there, well, that can't really do anything. That can't really impact our physical world. So if psi was shown to be happening, then it was assumed that it would be game over. The non-physical is affecting the physical. We can no longer rely on this scientific materialism. And that, of course, is why there was this tremendous pushback on psi. So the James Randi folks and all the very materialistic people would just rail against parapsychology and all the psi stuff as hard as they could and make up a bunch of crap that we've gone over again and again and again on the show to show that their debunking of psi was really a sham. Which it is. Now, also in that long list of things that got the strong pushback was remote viewing. So if you go back 20 years ago, what everyone's saying, oh, that never really happened, it never really worked. And then you had people coming out of the program going, of course it worked. And even had presidents saying, oh yeah, that was unbelievable what they found. They found this missing plane. All these stories came out that made it clear to anyone who was paying attention that yes, something real was happening. Now, all this is a lead up to how this show came to be. Because the other day I was watching this excellent video by the very excellent parapsychologist, Dr. Jeffrey Mishlove, who you might recall was on this show a long time ago. Probably need to have him back, need to make a note of that. But anyway, on his new revamped version of Thinking Aloud, he had on today's guest, Dr. Ed May. And I was rather stunned to find that here is a guy who's a PhD physicist, ran the Stargate program for 10 years, is absolutely certain from all his scientific training that this is something that really occurred. That is, psychic spying is real, was real, really happened. They sat in this room and they saw stuff that was going on the other side of the world. He's saying, operationally, we know it happened. Experimentally, we know it happened. It happened. Get over it. But at the same time, what he's saying is that, you know what? I'm still a physicalist. I'm still a materialist. I'm still holding to the idea that it's all in the brain. Mind equals brain. So, of course, that piqued my interest. And I reached out to Ed and was able to get him to agree to come on the show to talk about so many of the things that I'm interested in. Now, it turned out to be quite a contentious interview at times. Ed's got a lot of strong opinions. He's not afraid to express them. And I, as you know, am generally not someone to back down from asking questions that, I don't know, sometimes do piss people off. Now, Ed says a bunch of stuff in this interview that, in the final analysis, I think is a little bit out there, but we can discuss that later and pull that apart in the forum. But there's one thing that he said that I really did want to follow up on directly, and that was his comment about Dean Radin, because I've always found Dean Radin to be absolutely one of the smartest guys in the room when it comes to parapsychology, and certainly a top-notch, careful researcher. So when Ed did his little shtick on Dean Radin's recent double-slit experiment, I really knew I wanted to follow up with that. I was able to have a little email correspondence with Dean, and I will update you on what I discovered at the end of the show, which is coming up right now. Today we welcome Dr. Ed May to Skeptico. Dr. May is a physicist with a PhD in low-energy experimental nuclear physics, but is probably best known as being the former director of the U.S. intelligence's psychic spy program, codename Project Stargate, all the remote viewing stuff that you've heard so much about. Dr. May has been recognized with a Lifetime Achievement Award from the Parapsychology Association and has authored a couple of books, and of course, probably dozens, I'm sure it's hundreds of academic research papers in the field of parapsychology. Ed is also the author of ESP Wars East and West, a book he co-authored with Joe McConnell, Lloyd Arbeck, and Russian psychic spy expert Viktor Rubel. Listeners might recall that we actually had Lloyd Arbeck on a couple years ago to talk about that very, very fascinating book. So, Ed, as I was just mentioning, there's a ton of stuff I'd love to talk about. I'm certainly very honored and glad that you've joined me. Thanks so much for being here.
Oh, my pleasure, Alex. I think this will be a lot of fun and I hope informative for some people. Let's go for it.
All right. Well, let's go for it. And let's start with a question that you suggested we might discuss. And it is a very interesting question at that. Here is the question you put to me that I might want to ask and put to you is, given that psi phenomena are so weak and difficult to observe, why should anyone care? And what struck me, rather than ask that question directly, is, do you really think psi phenomena are always weak and difficult to observe?
I certainly do. And in fact, let me give you a little sort of a hint. You know, if you have a favorite band you enjoy listening to, the last way you'd ever want to listen to it is through two tin cans and a string connecting them, right? It would sound horrible. So you switch to AM radio and it sounds better, but it, you know, it still doesn't capture the nuances of the music. Then you switch to FM and it gets even better. And finally, you might get high definition audio, which is even the best. What characterizes that string of stuff? The answer is bandwidth. How wide of frequencies can the information come through? We have a really good idea now, qualitative for sure, about what the bandwidth of ESP is. And to use a highly technical term, which you might have to explain, it sucks. It's extremely slow. And so the amount of information that's even in principle capable of going from a future or some event in Bombay, India tomorrow to here now is extremely limited in terms of the information that you can get that way.
Okay, but I guess I'd turn that around and suggest that you're talking about bandwidth within a realm that we didn't even think existed, and a lot of people still don't think exists. So, you know, weak and difficult, maybe not very good compared to this Skype connection, but compared to something we have we don't even know what it is. But given that we've established that there is something, it's the only thing we have. And let me put it, kind of change the framing of it from a scientific perspective. You know, okay. Like Daryl Bem recently published a meta-analysis of his precognition experiments that
Sure. You
were just kind of referring to, the precognition aspect.
Yeah.
He got an overall effect of 6 sigma. I mean,
Yeah. That's
off the charts. That's decisive evidence, the kind that any physicist would die for. That's not fitting in the weak and difficult to observe category, is it?
I don't want to get really geeky on you. I was born a geek, so please forgive me here, and I'll try to make this a little simple.
No, we're all geeky friends here. It's no problem.
Are you familiar with Professor Jessica Utz, statistician?
Sure.
She's currently the chair of the statistics department at University of California at Irvine, and I think she just stepped down from her year appointment as president of the American Statistical Association. She's, at that time, the top statistician in the country. And what she points out, that the Six Sigma figure you talk about, that's related to so-called p-values, and the main thing that drives those big numbers is how many trials you take. So if you ask what psychologists have been doing lately, instead of being enamored with a big number like Six Sigma, and that's very impressive for sure, they switch to something called effect size, which pretends it's a way of computing how big and important the effect is, given that you only took a single trial rather than, 15 or 100. Daryl Bem's work is brilliant. I'm not denigrating his work at all, and Six Sigma is very important, but the overall effect size is pretty weak.
Right, but what a lot of people would point out is that the only reason these guys switched to looking at, oh my gosh, it's all about effect size, which really, if you look at other areas of science, we have all, you look in your area of physics, we have all sorts of very, very important phenomena that have extremely small effect sizes. So what the psychology people seem to have done to me is say, gee, we really don't like those kind of results that Daryl Bem and some of these other parapsychologists are getting. We need to challenge everything we're doing in psychology and the social sciences with regard to statistics.
You just made my point for me. The fact is that just because it's a weak and small effect doesn't mean it's unimportant or not real. I mean, some of the most important things in physics and other areas of science have little tiny effect sizes, but they are still extremely important and important to figure out how, in fact, this works. You said we don't have any idea how it works, but my colleague and I have published in Sage Open, which is a respected online journal for human-oriented sciences, what we call the multiphasic model of precognition. It does something really fun. The model may be completely wrong, but there's one part of it that isn't. That is, we broke up the problem space into two chunks. Let's assume that someone's going to randomly generate an ESP target in Bombay, India or Mumbai, India tomorrow. And how does that information get from there then to here now? That's a physics problem only that doesn't depend upon any aspect of being human, about consciousness or any of that stuff.
How do we know that, though? That's an assumption.
Well, it's more than just assumption. All the neuroscience and all the physics suggest that's true. That doesn't mean that it is true, but right now that's the best we got. And so one question is, for example, suppose you're sitting on the beach watching the sunset with a really good friend. And how do you know what's happening at the sun? Why is that so beautiful as it sinks into the Pacific Ocean here on the west coast of the U.S.? The answer to that is photons, the signaling, are coming from the sun, propagating through space and through time and space, get to your retina, and you have an internal experience, right? And I'm sitting next to you and have a totally different experience from the same set of photons coming at me. How does that happen? The answer to how that happens is information is propagating through space, which is extremely well understood for the last 120 years. So, there are some physical realities out there which are known to be true independent of human experience.
Yes, but it does seem to ultimately come down to a matter of understanding consciousness as best we can, because that's what keeps creeping into the equation. And I don't know that we've really tackled that question at all in terms of what is consciousness, what is necessary and sufficient to cause consciousness, when does it begin, when does it end, does it collapse the wave function? Our friend Dr. Dean Radin has at least taken a stab at saying, okay, there's this long-standing debate in physics regarding the observer effect and can consciousness collapse the wave function. So let's do an experiment. And he's the first guy to say, okay, let's put a meditator up. We'll set up the classic double slit experiment with a little photon beam. Let's see if a meditator can affect that photon beam in the double slit experiment. And again, an astounding result. I mean, a statistically overwhelming result that yes, human consciousness collapses the wave function. So once we factor in consciousness or what we don't know about consciousness, I'm just not sure that we can be that sure about what's going on with ESP, precognition, for example.
This is sounding a bit bragging on my part, but as far as I know right now, I'm the only person in the entire field of parapsychology that spent 10 years doing quantum physics experimentally. And Dean Radin is a good friend of mine. He is simply one of the most creative people we have in our field. But I'm sad to report his idea of consciousness and wave functions are just demonstrably inconsistent with 80 years worth of experiment and theory. It's just simply not the case. Now, with his permission, in that double slit experiment, I said, Dean, there are no mysteries of the double slit experiment. Do you mind if I model that mathematically? And he said, by all means. So I was able to set together a mathematical program using something called MATLAB, that doesn't matter. And I was able to reproduce mathematically all the figures in his paper. All right. And I had only one what's called free parameter. I said, OK, if Dean is right, and leaving whether it's consciousness or quantum mechanics, the observable is he got a really strong effect. No question. The question then is, how many photons would have to be, and I'm putting in air quotes, coerced to go through one and only one slit? Because that's the only way he can get the effect, and he agrees with that. Turns out it's a tad under 90% of the photons, and even he says that's extremely unlikely. Now, there's another explanation for that same data, and it comes with what's called experimenter effect or a mathematical model called decision augmentation theory. And when I applied that to his data, it fell right in line. So there are at least two competing hypotheses that would explain the same data. And in my view, quantum mechanics is not a good way to go. So, and I can tell you why.
Please, go ahead.
It's very simple. For that to work, the wave function of the brain has to go out of the skull across. I've been to his laboratory up in Marin County. You have to go. It has to go like 2 or 3 meters across the lab, or through a steel wall into an apparatus, which is also made of metal. So the question is, can wave functions do that? And the only way you can have a coherent wave function that goes that far is that the origin, in this case, the brain, has to act like a collective quantum mechanical thing. So, do you happen to know what the current record is? And physicists compete all the time to say, what is the largest chunk we can show that acts like a collective quantum mechanical device or quantum mechanical system? The current record, at least a year and a half ago, it may be broken now, is 500,000 rubidium ions. Rubidium is one of the elements. And they are able to demonstrate that those 500,000 rubidium atoms, which is too small a speck to see without an unaided, you know, with the unaided eye, can act as a collective quantum mechanical thing and have a one wave function that describes the whole system. That's the good news. The bad news is it's billionths of a few degrees above absolute zero. And if you raise the temperature ever slightly, it goes away. There is certainly a collective wave function for the brain and a bowling ball, but the extension doesn't even get through the skull. And that, I'm not making that up. That's the end result of theory and experiment for 80-some-odd years.
Very good. And I'm glad you added that part that you're not making it up. Not that anyone thinks that you're making it up. But more importantly, I do understand why physicists like yourself get frustrated with people kind of slopping around some of these quantum physics terms and not acknowledging the amount of real work and real math. I mean, if anyone wants to go read these papers, the math just becomes an immediate barrier. You go, holy crap. I mean, that's how they know what they know kind of stuff. But at the same time, I do understand the appeal of Dean Radin taking things to that level. And not only the appeal of it, I think it gets at the central question that you yourself acknowledge is still the question, you know, what really is going on? And you have one camp and this, you have, and then there's this other camp that says, no, it really does suggest a different way of thinking about consciousness, a way that kind of shatters the materialistic mind equals brain paradigm that we're on. And really, I think it's fundamentally to answering the second part of your question, your original question of why should we care? I mean, I think that's why we really care, is because if consciousness really is different than this materialistic mind equal brain kind of thing, then we have to really rethink a lot of things in science. And we've been down this path, Ed, on this show. And that's why, I mean, I think the psi stuff is interesting and fun to talk about up to a point. But where the rubber really meets the road is when you look at some related phenomena. I mean, I take, for example, and this is going to relate right back into your work in Stargate, but the near-death experience science. I mean, there, it's kind of game over, because now we have the brain out of the equation. The brain
No. Absolutely not. I've just been engaged in a huge debate over this issue of near-death experiences, arguing with my colleagues that that is hard evidence for survival of bodily death. First off, there's nobody that has had a near-death experience who is in fact dead. That's a different category.
Not true.
Yes, it meets.
If we were going to answer that question,
I've read the literature in detail and just finished reading a book about that by one of the biggest proponents, sir.
Just not. Let me point you to the people you'd want to talk to. The people you'd want to talk to really get at that question is, what is death? Is you'd want to talk to people like a cardiologist, like Pin Van Lommel, or a radiation oncologist like Jeff Long. But who you'd really want to talk to is, you'd really want to look at somebody who's an expert in resuscitation, who's an expert in dying. So if you look at one of the world leading experts is Dr. Sam Parnia, formerly at Cornell, well known for his near-death experience research. He has studied this more extensively than anyone else in terms of what is really death.
Are you assuming that I'm not familiar with some of this literature?
Ed, I'm speaking to our audience in general. Otherwise, it sounds like inside baseball. So Sam Parnia has spent 20 years specifically answering that charge and that claim. And he, along with every other near-death experience researcher who's really published in this field, has come to the same conclusion that, yes, this is highly suggestive that consciousness does survive bodily death.
Okay. Can I express an alternative view?
Yes, please go ahead.
Thank you. First off, wouldn't say close friends with, but I was certainly a welcomed colleague and had many in-person conversations with a fellow that spent his entire career looking at survival after bodily death. That's Ian Stevenson, a physician from the University of Virginia.
Sure.
He would not agree that NDE's survival of that is anything at all what he was concerned about in terms of survival of bodily death. The question, which I am definitely interested in and don't know the answer. In fact, worse, I would like Stevenson's research to be true. It's much more interesting than my personal view at the moment as a materialist. That is, when you die and I cook you in the crematorium and your brain turns out to be white ash, that's dead. The question is, do you survive? Is there some aspects of Alex that survives that particular experience? That is what I call survival after bodily death. The fact that you meet the medical definition of death, I agree. In fact, they even do, it's part of the cardiac and brain surgery literature that they actually kill you, in quotes, on the table by taking out a lot of your blood and lowering your body temperature so you go flatline. You meet the current medical definition of death. That's not what Stevenson meant by survival. If you ask, do you survive the medical definition of death? I have no problem. You do. But it seems to me we need to have a better definition of death these days.
I think we're kind of getting into a semantics game. The reason why that is the medical definition of death is what goes along with that is 50, 60 years of all the evidence we have of brain functioning, of EEG functioning, both in animals and humans, to suggest that we have no way of understanding how the human brain could generate anything like consciousness, like experience, like anything that these NDEers are experiencing after medically defined clinical death. So that's what they're really saying. They're saying we have all this research that suggests there's no way any of that stuff can be happening when someone is considered medically dead.
The question becomes, and you know, I've spent 50 years, in fact, researching parapsychological issues. What we don't have any knowledge of, Alex, is when information becomes available to the recipient. So here you are at the operating table, you are declared dead, and you get revived by modern medical technology, how sweet that is, and you had some experience while you were, quote, dead. The question becomes, and there is yet no answer to this, when did you acquire that information? When your brain was gone and flatlined, or precognitively before you were hit, or postcognitively after you wake up? Nobody knows the answer to that question, and I wish to hell I did, but I don't know the answer to that one. But it raises the question when that information became available.
Well, as listeners to this show will be tired of me talking about by now, I think we have a pretty good indication of that, or at least an indication.
Really? Come on, Alex. Nobody does. You know,
let me tell you about the research. So if you go look at Dr. Penny Sartori, you know, a colleague of both Sam Parnia and Peter Fenwick, both very esteemed researchers, not just NDE researchers, but medical researchers. If you go look at her research, also this research was replicated by Dr. Jan Holden at the University of North Texas. What they did is looked at NDEers' ability to recollect their resuscitation process, right?
So, yes, but you don't know, nor do they know when they got that information. That's the key here. I'm not arguing that information doesn't appear to be really stunning, and it is. I'm agreeing with that. What I know from my own research and that of many others, we wish to hell we had control over when one gathers that information. Let me give you one example, an experimental example we did at Stanford. We were looking at, have you ever heard of something called event-related desynchronization? Let me explain what that is. Every known human activity interrupts alpha. To be crude about it, the brain in idle, it produces alpha rhythms. And everything it is known that a human can do, at least momentarily, interrupts that alpha rhythm. And that's called technically event-related desynchronization. So we argued, well, if thinking about something or having a stimulus or whatever interrupts alpha, so too must the ESP and remote viewing and all that should interrupt it. What we did, a very careful experiment at Stanford, run by Stephen LaBerge at Stanford at the time, was to see whether we could see alpha rhythms going away when someone was psychic. The problem we had, we didn't see it, even though we had an independent measure of very high quality, very statistically significant remote viewing while we were measuring their EEG brainwaves looking for alpha power changes. The answer is, when Joe McMonagle, one of the best remote viewers in the country, would be coming driving to Stanford, he'd have a psychic hit before he even got into the laboratory, not under his control. Then when you put him in the EEG, he's not being psychic at all. What he's doing is recalling something that happened to him 20 minutes earlier. That is a problem that all of us have, including the NDEers, researchers.
Right. But it takes on a different aspect or a different question when those events happen after we die, right? So back to, you know, Penny Sartori's research, if you're medically dead, that is your brain is out of the equation, and then things continue, and you have this continuity, you know, we have to say in the NDE literature and that science, there's a continuity of experience, right? So I die, I'm outside of my body, I'm seeing everything happen, I'm medically pronounced dead, now they're doing the resuscitation, and I recall all that, there is this continuity of experience. So before you can say,
Whoa, slow down. I'm not going to let you get away with that. when you say continuity experience, you don't know whether it's continuous or not, because they they cannot report to you while their brain is dysfunctioning. All you know is beforehand they had some experience, and afterhand when they wake up they have some experience, and they report to you afterwards what they saw while they were, quote, dead. You don't know whether they got that after, retrocognitively, by normal ESP way to do it. You can't do that. You just can't.
Well, I mean, that really gets at the heart of some kind of philosophical question.
No, it's by direct measure in the laboratory, my friend, direct measure about when psi is available to people. We've been looking at this for 50 years. Well, it's just not philosophy.
It is in the sense of the assumption that consciousness is a product of the brain is an assumption. And what a lot of people are doing looking at this same data is saying we need to challenge that assumption and somehow look at a model where consciousness is somehow fundamental to this whole experience. And I think for a lot of people, including myself, it then offers a better explanation. Because you can say there's not this continuity of experience, but my whole point is that's how people experience it. That's how they report it.
But as Paul Churchman points out in Engine of Reason, Seat of the Soul, that when we try to figure out how the world works based on personal experience and all the big questions we have as humans gotten it wrong. This is another example of that, I'm afraid. By the way, if you want a good definition of consciousness, the best I'm aware with is from a fellow by the name of Giulio Tononi. He's written a fabulous book called Voyage from the Brain to the Soul. And yes, it's a materialist perspective that the mind and brain are equivalent, which is my current position. I'm willing to be talked out of it. I didn't start there in my career in that direction, but all the data that I'm familiar with leads me in that, including the NDE work. So why don't we talk about something else, which would be more interesting?
Okay, well, I don't know. I think this is pretty interesting. I think it's pretty central.
But it's not an area of my expertise. You're wasting your time with me. You should get somebody like Stephen Schwartz, who's a really clever guy, or Ed Kelly. I think you did interview Ed at one time.
Stephen Schwartz, have interviewed him too. And I interviewed Jeffrey Schwartz as well from UCLA. This is a topic we talk about a lot. So, no, we can move on. But I'll move on only slightly because, you know, you're friends with Joe McConnell. You worked with him for a long time.
30 years.
He is known as psychic spy number one as part of the Stanford.
He's one of about a dozen people I work with equal ability, yeah.
So when I interviewed Joe a couple of years ago, one of the things I found fascinating about his story, and I'm sure you know this, is his own near-death experience.
Yep, he's had more than one.
Well, his first one, as I heard it, was, you know, he's a spy. I mean, a real, like in the movies kind of spy. And he's over there in East Germany or right on the border. And he suspects that they tried to kill him. They tried to poison him. So he dies, if you will, medically, and he has this out-of-body experience. He sees himself being wheeled to the hospital, and miraculously they bring him back. Mm-hmm. He comes back, and he's face-to-face with Army intelligence officers and saying, hey, what happened? Where are you? You know, and he then recounts his whole near-death experience, and it's a classic kind of near-death experience.
Sure.
The interesting thing I think about that story, or one of the interesting things, is that as Joe tells it, he shows up at Stanford Research Institute a few years later, interviewing to be part of the Stargate program. Hey, he's there with Dr. Hale Puthoff, Russell Targ, really top-notch scientists. A lot of times we throw around those names and think who they are. I mean, these guys are really, really top-notch scientists. And he's talking to them about joining the program, and they open up his top secret personnel file, and out of it they pull Raymond Moody's book, Life After Life, and they go, okay, great. This guy is the kind of guy we need. And that tells me two important things. Number one, near-death experiences or near-death experiencers have often for a long time reported an increased ability to perform psychic feats. This kind of connection with the psychic is enhanced after their near-death experience. But the other thing that it tells me is that United States intelligence was all over this stuff from the beginning, and they were very, very...
Wait a minute. I have to stop you there. You know, the CIA released about 89,000 pages of the entire Stargate record, dating back to 1972 through 1995, all right? My colleague and I are just close to finishing a series of four lengthy volumes of what we're calling the Stargate Archives. We are intimately familiar with all the back and forth within the agencies, with various agencies, CIA, NSA, what have you, as well as all the work that was done at SRI. Of course, I was there from 1976 onward. I was there before Joe McMonagle was. And I guarantee you that the federal government was not in the slightest bit interested other than the materialist approach. And I can demonstrate that by hard memos go back and forth between the CIA, DIA, and us. So it's a wonderful story. And let me, another postscript to that is, as I told
you, it's Joe McConnell's story. I'm not adding anything to it.
You're really beginning to piss me off. Joe McMonagle is a damn good psychic and a personal friend of mine. I will travel to the end of the earth for brothers. But it will be the first to tell you that he is only one of about a dozen people with equal kinds of skill. And none of the others, zero of the others, had near-death experiences. A near-death experience may be a sufficient condition for good psychic functioning, but it is by no means necessary to be top-of-the-line good psychics. And that's a problem.
Ed, I don't know why you're getting pissed off when I'm telling you Joe's story. This is what Joe says.
I'm familiar with Joe McMonagle's story, and that was not, we did not do Raymond Moody anything on our project. We just didn't.
Didn't say that you did. I said that out of his, he was surprised that out of his top secret dossier, they pull Raymond Moody's book. And that was the connection that he made. So, you know, because he actually corrected me during the interview. I said, you know, you were surprised. I bet you were surprised to know that they had some knowledge of this. And he said, no, it's much more than that. They were excited and welcoming to the fact that I had an NDE because they felt that that further qualified me in some way as being likely to be successful in the program. That's Joe's account. I'm not adding anything to that.
Yeah, that's fine. That doesn't mean that's what actually happened, but that's Joe's account. And I know it's Joe's account.
Okay. I'm okay with that. So, you know, you have a ton of experience, more than a ton of experience there. So we're just trying to get all this stuff out so people can sort it out. But let's back up because you said a little bit. Tell folks again exactly what you did there, when you did it, and some of the details there. Because I think it's a very important part of history. Let's get that out there.
Okay. I did my first experiment in psychokinesis in 1971 when I was a postdoc in the cyclotron lab at UC Davis, California. And I'd been interested. I spent a year with in India chasing miracles. And when I returned back from India, I worked at Maimonides Medical Center in Brooklyn, which was kind of the stalwart at the time. Nobody knew then about the program at SRI. And I ran into and became close friends with Ingo Swann at that time. And excuse me, we published some work together at Maimonides. Excuse me, I'm just getting over cold. And Ingo said, you know, there's this interesting program going on at SRI. I think you would be a welcome contributor being a physicist. And I said, okay, fine. I don't know what's going on out there. Long story short, I joined in late 75, maybe early 76. I can't remember exactly when, as a consultant, and worked closely then as a consultant. And I think I became a member of the full-time staff in 79, maybe 78. It was before Fort Meade was established as a senior research physicist. Russell Targ left the program in 1982, and Hal Puthoff left the program in 85. And at that time, I became the director of research for the Stargate program. It wasn't called Stargate way back then. It was other different names. So my job from 1985 to 1995 was in support of the Fort Meade group and others in terms of research support. My background in experimental nuclear physics was brought to the fore, and we had, it was not happened before my time on the program, we had a scientific oversight committee made up of 12 members of the who's who of science in the country. And when these books will be released sometime next year, you'll get the names of them, one of whom I'll reveal now. The entrance requirement for the Scientific Oversight Committee was determined by the Army. The entrance requirement was you had to be skeptical about the phenomena to begin with. However, you had to profess open-mindedness. And this was a 5-year commitment on their terms to join this group. And one of the things, they had 3 jobs. One is to review our protocols before we actually did an experiment. In other words, approve of them. That went pretty easily because we were pretty good at what we were doing. The second requirement or skill that they had, or rather action they had, was unannounced drop-in privileges. Well, they actually never did that. But the third responsibility they had, which was very, very important and actually the pinnacle of my intellectual career, was that we had to send our final reports to them, which they were to review in writing, which is part of the formal record as appended to our final reports to the clients, of everything that we concluded as the result of the experiments that we had done. And there's good news and bad news. The good news is we won about 85% of the arguments we got in with them. They came to SRI after reviewing all this stuff. We'd sit around for 2 days arguing. And the good news is we managed to win 85% of those arguments. The better news, by far the most fantastic news, was the 15% we lost with them. We sharply improved what we were doing as a result of that interaction. One of those people, now deceased, is a Nobel laureate in physics named Melvin Schwartz. Mel and I had been longtime friends for years and years and years, but any before I got long involved in this, we did physics together and business together and so on. And when he got the Nobel Prize, I called him up and I said, "Hey, Mel, why don't you be on our scientific oversight committee?" And he said, "Ed, you know, I think this whole thing's a whole line of BS." And I said, "Fine. Why do you want me?" And I said, "Well, it's your Nobel Prize that looks good on the masthead. How cool is that?" And besides which, Mel, I think you're an honest scientist. He says, "Okay, what if I'm on your committee for a year and at the end of the year, I believe what I now believe it's all BS. What will you do?" And I said, "Mel, if you can convince the other members of the committee that it's all BS, I will then quit immediately and come to work with you at Brookhaven National Laboratory doing physics." He said, "Done." I said, "Mel, we're not even close to done." I said, "What do you mean?" And I said, "What if, after watching us for a year, that you and the other members of the committee feel that there's something worthy of study here, then what?" And that caught him off guard. And he thought for a moment. He said, "I'll tell you what, I'll spend some fraction of my career helping you to figure out how it works." And he did that up to about a year before he passed away.
That's quite an amazing story. And I really get a sense for how you, as a physicist, were trying to bring that rigor. Not that there wasn't rigor before, but, you know, we're constantly trying to bring this mainstream science body of knowledge we have to the work. I think that's really cool.
Thank you.
So I really do. And that story is phenomenal and it has to get out there. And so people, it's an important part of the history. But at the risk of pissing you off again, let me kind of take a slightly different angle on that, because I think there's another current of interest that's going on that fascinates a lot of people. And you're probably in a pretty good place to fill in the gaps in this history as well, because one of the things that I've learned recently that I find fascinating and a lot of people find fascinating is Hal Puthoff, Pat Price, Ingo Swann, all these guys who are central to the Stargate program are deep, deep, deep into Scientology. Heavy hitters in the Scientology hierarchy and, you know, getting all those advanced degrees and all that stuff. What do you make of the Scientology connection in Stargate?
Well, it's an interesting question. I, too, was involved in the Church of Scientology for a brief period of time. And I'll tell you a story. When one gets super high clearances, which I had to have, eventually the FBI sent a couple of people out to interview you after talking to all your associates to make sure you're not a Russian spy or, you know, blackmailable. And they asked me that very same question, because what happened was Pat Price was, in my view, a traitor, because what Pat did was, first of all, he left SRI and went to work for the agency directly with a guy named Ken Kress. And for many years that they worked together, Pat Price was stealing secret documents and sending it to the Church of Scientology in L.A. Why he did that, I don't know. I never met Pat, so I don't know what his motivations were. In 1979, the FBI raided what's called the C Organization in L.A. and found all these secret documents from SRI, you know, documents that we had authored, but were sitting there that Pat had stolen from CIA. And so when I came time for my interview with the good cop, bad cop, two FBI guys, they asked me, well, what are your feelings about the Church of Scientology? And I'm never a coward, or, you know, I like to push back, as you've already noticed. I said, let me see, get this straight. Are you asking me to clarify my First Amendment rights of freedom of religion? And the World Council of Religions lists the Church of Scientology, whether you like it or not, as a valid religion. You may not like it, but fine. That's not a problem. And boy, they did a freelance backpedal like you wouldn't believe. And I said, okay, now let's get this clear. I will waive those rights. What do you want to know about the Church of Scientology? Well, do you think there's a Scientology conspiracy? The question you just asked me. And I said, are you kidding? Most of those people that have Scientology on the project don't even communicate themselves with each other. We all have differing viewpoints. There was a lot of, you know, like any complicated program, and that, you know, there are factions within it. We didn't get along very well, actually. We worked well together as a team doing science, but on matters of those kinds of things, there was not a conspiracy at all. In fact, mm-hmm. if anything, there was an anti-conspiracy. Mm-hmm. Both Hal and Ingo had left the church, and I certainly didn't last very long, because it's a crazy organization. So, hey, it was part of the human potential movement in the 70s. We were all involved doing stupid stuff. That was my stupid stuff.
Great. And you know what? I can easily see it all fitting into that category. There's just one other, I think, area to clear up their connection to make, and that is to go back on that history a little bit. A lot of people don't know that, you know, L. Ron Hubbard had a career in U.S. Navy intelligence, and that early on, and this is kind of well documented, U.S. intelligence is like pursuing him, saying, you know, hey, what have you gone and figured out? Because he goes and does a bunch of really crazy stuff, right? I mean, he's out there in the desert with Jack Parsons, who's military intelligence, and they're summoning demons and doing all this stuff. And Jack Parsons is communicating back to Aleister Crowley and saying, you know, this guy is the real deal. I mean, all this stuff is in the history books, but what is also in the history books is U.S. intelligence. And I think this is understandable in the way that you are kind of saying, you know, there's different layers and understanding of this. They want to know what this guy knows, whether he knows anything. And then there's this ongoing battle where Hubbard is saying, hey, we can't let these guys get their hands on this because they want to weaponize it. They want to do it for all these bad things, and we're the good guys. Do you have any insight or sense, you just added some, to what's going on there between U.S. intelligence and maybe their desire to get that information flowing back the other way? Hey, that is, does Scientology know something that we should know? Do you have any insights in that?
First of all, I never heard that, I'm not a Scientology buff. I didn't even know that he was involved with it was in the Navy or anything like that. The only thing I knew of L. Ron Hubbard is he was a somewhat interesting science fiction writer, which he liberally stole from traditions all over the world to create the Dianetics, the modern science of mental health. But nonetheless, look, we were at Cold War with the Soviets during that period of time. The intelligence community was willing to try anything, including asking psychics in crazy California whether they could help. They looked at the Monroe Institute from Robert Monroe area. They looked at the Church of Scientology, God knows whatever things they looked at. They were desperate. In fact, one of the reasons we were funded was because the intelligence community didn't care exactly at all how we got the data. They just wanted to know whether our data was any damn good or not. And if you had to be naked standing in the corner on your head spitting out M&Ms, if that's the way you got the data, they couldn't care less. And it drove us crazy in the early years. Why? Because we were scientists. We wanted to know how this stuff worked. They didn't give two flying anythings about how this stuff worked as long as it worked. They wouldn't, and it wasn't until I landed a $10 million contract with the Army Medical Research and Development Command, where I had a charter. 85% of that money could be spent on basic research. How does this stuff work?
So that's an interesting kind of interplay there that is really has to be kind of fleshed out a little bit further. So you're the scientist and you want to know what's really going on here. How does this stuff work? What is the underlying mechanism?
Sure.
And they're very task-oriented, mission-oriented. Tell me a little bit, if you will, just kind of freewheel about personally how you feel we find that balance between and justifies the means kind of intelligence, which, because on one hand, they're right. That's what they have to do. That's their job. Right. And on the other hand, trying to figure out where we draw the lines of both inquiry in terms of what we want to find out, but also in terms of what's wrong and what's right, what we should allow and shouldn't allow. Because those are questions that are very, very relevant today. And in a way, you guys were looking at them in a way that no one even imagined years ago. I mean, you're talking, like you said, you're being nice when you say sit in the corner and spit out M&Ms, but they're also like talking to Satanists and, you know, so they were just, they just said, hey, whatever, you know, that's Project MK Often, I think it is. But I mean, that was their task, just exactly the way you characterized it. Figure out what works.
Well, first off, what's really interesting to me, we kept saying the research that we did under my watch for sure was divided into two types of research. One was called application-oriented. In other words, what can we do to improve the product outcome, you know, make remote viewing better? And, you know, whether we should do it in the morning or do it at a local scenario time or whatever the environmental circumstances are such that we get a better product. That all those kinds of things we called, and our contractors, people who provided us money, we called application-oriented research. The other side of that is basic research. In other words, how does it work? Because the argument is, if we could get some handle how this works, we could improve the product because we would know what not to do and more importantly, what to do to get a better sense of what was happening. And that was something new on the project beginning in late, early 1976. I had a $2 million contract from the Med Command to actually start that road. The other issue that really comes to bear here, and it's not just remote viewing intelligence gathering, but it's intelligence gathering in general. That is, the intelligence value of something is only loosely connected to the quality of the data. Let me give you sort of hypothetical examples. We have satellites that can photograph exquisitely tiny things from space, right? And suppose you get satellite imagery of a new Russian tank, and we can practically count the rivets on the tank, and we know how it's constructed and all those details by this extremely high-quality data from satellite pictures. However, that may have zero intelligence value. Why? Because the people who are gathering that information from satellite imagery are unaware that the special forces stole one of those tanks, then they dismantled it completely in the building. There's nothing new that could be learned from it. The inverse of that is also true, that, you know, some photo interpreter looking at satellite images, well, it's through the clouds and the data is really poor. And they said an intelligence analyst or a photographic analyst might say, you know, I'm not sure what that blob is over the left and the right underneath that cloud, but that gives me an idea. Let me check another source, and cracks open the case. And there's a case where terrible data is, in fact, high quality, high value intelligence. Nobody has been able to solve that question. And it's a tough one. And remote viewing is not immune to that either. So we've had some marvelous and remote viewing examples that have zero intelligence value and vice versa.
That's very interesting and important. You know, I was trying to get you just your kind of personal opinion, and I'm going to ask it and maybe in a better way that you can hear. And because you're in a unique spot here, you're sitting there as a scientist and you're helping United States intelligence organization. I keep saying United States intelligence because you had like an alphabet soup of different clients, right? You had Army intelligence, you had CIA, right? So I'm just saying U.S. intelligence.
But let me jump in here just briefly. You know, we get branded, Angela Ford and I were in Moscow a year ago, December, and we were billed on Russian television as CIA spies. I kept saying, hey, we're not CIA spies, don't tell us that while we're here in Russia. No,
yeah, if you're going to say that, say we're Army spies, Navy spies, FBI spies.
Yeah, right. It turns out that out of the nominally $20 million, CIA gave us directly about $195,000 only. They were one of the least contributors of money to our project. The vast majority of money came from the Defense Intelligence Agency and the Army Medical Research and Development Command. They accounted for most of the funding. Now, you're asking me whether I think that's important to do.
And where do you draw the line is what I'm really asking, because that's relevant to right now today. You know, I mean, we've been through, just like you said, of the satellite or the drones, you put it anywhere. You know, it's the could we question and how do we question, which is the science part of it. And then there's the should we question.
That's a really interesting point. Joe McMonagle and I were both knighted in the Order of St. Stanislaus, which, you know, sword on the shoulder and all that stuff in the Washington Cathedral, because the Order of St. Stanislaus is a chivalrous order. It was the government in exile from in Poland during World War II. Since then, they're basically a philanthropic organization. And the reason we were honored by that, both Joe and I, was because we contributed, albeit, frankly, very slightly, to the liberation of Eastern Europe. And that was a worthy goal. Now, does that mean I'm not going to defend the intelligence community for everything? They've done some really horrific stuff, particularly the CIA. We all know about the horrific stuff they've done. But for the most part, I was proud to serve in that capacity to look, you can't fight a war unless you have secrets. And what we did was to contribute slightly of not allowing the opposition to have secrets. Since that time, by the way, I've become close friends with our former KGB enemies. And we party hardy whenever I go to Moscow, which is many, many, many times, about 22 times at this stage.
Right. No, I think that's a great perspective. I mean, we're in the secret business. We're in the conspiracy business, whether we want to or not. It's part of being a superpower, right? Kind of a related question, I think, and then we can kind of wrap this up. I appreciate very, very much your openness and you're willing to talk about, you know, all these different things. And it's kind of related, and it's, you know, so Stargate, it's remote viewing, and most people have an opinion about how real it is. I think you come down very clearly that it's real as a scientist, as a hard-nosed scientist. There's no getting around the data. You're pretty clear about that. But it seemed to also be part of a larger program interested in mind control, mind aspects. Of course, many people have heard about MKUltra, and that all became public because they did it up in Canada, and they have different kind of freedom of information laws, and they sued them, and they got a lot of stuff out in the public domain. And you mentioned the Fort Meade group. You know, how would you put Stargate as part of the larger interest that U.S. intelligence had in the mind, mind control, how our enemies might be trying to control our mind collectively, how we might want to do that as well? I mean, any thoughts on that?
I wrote a book called ESP Wars East and West, and now there's a Russian version of it. And the foreword in that book is Nikolai Shom, the second in command of KGB before the KGB went away and changed its name. And I've had many, many interactions with Shom, and one of them was they had funded, he personally in that role had funded 40 research institutes across the former Soviet Union to develop what is called psychotronic weaponry. That is mind control at a distance. All right. And he said, you know, we spent all this money. We could not make it work. And we had a big laugh. I said, God, if you guys had been able to make that work, you would have won the Cold War. And we flung down some vodka to salute that particular observation. The CIA got into a lot of trouble, and one of the reasons they abandoned us is inadvertently our program was put on a mind control slide in some briefing somewhere with the director of CIA saw it and said, kill all those programs. Because the U.S. government, by Congress, especially after the Nixon era, got into a tremendous amount of difficulty with so-called mind control, MKUltra, and other things prior to all that. Finally, it just seems to me that if you have, I don't think you can do mind control in that way. And so I think we're safe.
You know, Ed, you mentioned briefly during our talk there these books that you're working on that sound like they're going to be an important contribution in helping people sort through some of this history and all those documents that are out there. But it really takes an expert hand to kind of weave through those and weave a story. Not that your story is the only story, but your story is definitely a story that needs to be told. Tell folks more about those books, when they're coming out. You said you might want to talk about one of the titles.
Okay, if you go to Amazon and just type in my name, Edwin C. May, you'll see covers of these books. What happened is, it's not my story. It's the story of Stargate, which is only the last nickname of a bunch of them. Can I tell a funny story about one of the nicknames?
Yeah, please do.
I was walking out of the Pentagon with an Army colonel who said, hey, we've just changed the nickname of the project, and it's now called Quantum Leap. Aren't you excited, given that you're a physicist in Quantum Leap? And I said, oh, gosh, Colonel, no, I'm really not excited. Well, why not? And I said, a quantum leap forward progress is the smallest possible progress above none. And I said, can't we find a better name? Which is true. So the interesting thing to me, first of all, in going through all this stuff, and I'll answer your question momentarily, we had virtually chump change support for Stargate. I mean, it was $20 million spread out over 20 years with a big variance. Sometimes there was no money at all for a couple of years, and our management is pacing down the hall and measuring the drakes because they're going to throw us out to cash rich when I had a five-year $10 million program. But even that sounds like a lot of money for research parapsychology, but my goodness, it's chump change for the intelligence community. And yet, our program had visibility far exceeding what the money suggests. We know exactly that the president of the United States was briefed by our project, and we know what he was briefed upon. Two vice presidents were briefed on our program, exactly what we know what they were briefed upon. Head of CIA, head of DOE, head of all the major elements within the executive branch of the government were briefed, in fact, had to even pass on our program. One of the things in the introduction of all of the four volumes, we have a letter requesting the DCI, the Director of Central Intelligence, which in those days was the top dog in all the intelligence community, signed off on our program going forward with his signature, and we have that in these books. So what have we done? Well, we've taken the entire collection of documents released by CIA and others that CIA didn't have. And without changing the content, because our goal here is to provide some material that 50 years from now, scholars can decide, oh, what did these guys do for that money? And they will be able to answer that question. And so there are three volumes which involve the research. All the remote viewing and everything associated with remote viewing from 1972 to 1984. That includes how we found people, how we knew what we had, what the protocols were, what the correlations were with physiology and physics and what have you. Everything you could possibly think that would be of interest to remote viewing is in that volume from 72 to 84. The second volume is the same stuff, except this time from 85 onward to 95 when the program closed. The third volume, and these will all be about 400-page, 8.5 by 11 books, with tons of equations and tons of figures and so on, I think it'll be given an award by the American Insomniac Association as an instant cure. No one's hardly ever going to buy those books. The third volume is on psychokinesis. It's not well known how much work we did in psychokinesis. Why? The Army wanted to be able to distort the flight paths of incoming missiles if the Soviets attacked us. So they had a vested interest in see whether we could make psychokinesis work. And finally, volume four, the last of the series, is going to be the most interesting one, I think. And that is, these are documents, memos, letters with some very high powerful people commenting about our program that are government oriented, government originated. All the other three volumes are contractor originated. And these will be out sometime by probably the fall of this coming year. I've been working on this with a colleague in India for 4 years. One thing of note, last November, in November of 2015, I was the cover story of Time magazine. And at that, not Time, excuse me, Newsweek.
Hmm.
And
in the psychic spying thing?
Yeah. And in that was a former Secretary of Defense, William S. Cohen, was outed for his interest in this particular topic as Secretary of Defense. And I've known Cohen ever since. He was instrumental in helping us get funding from 1986, 89 onward, actually. So Angela Ford, one of the remote viewers from Fort Meade, and I have known Cohen for some time. So we went to visit him. He's long since retired from government and has what's called the Cohen Group on 8th Street in Washington. And we go in to check into the receptionist downstairs. And I say, Angela Ford and Ed Mayer here to meet with Secretary Cohen. Excuse me. And the receptionist said, oh, Bill, first name, is expecting you. So you get a clue that the lowest person on the food chain there calls him by his first name. So we go upstairs, and I've protected Bill Cohen like crazy for over the years. I met with him in his office probably 20 times when he was a senator.
And you were protecting him because? Why were you protecting him?
Because why would I out somebody's interest, which was not generally known? And the reason I would not want to do that, in fact, even today, this is an interesting side story, though, Alex. I'm allowed to use the name of Jack Verona. Jack Verona, if I had to single out one person that was responsible for Stargate, is Jack Verona, a PhD physicist, former director of Deputy Director for Science and Technology at DIA, worked for CIA before that. He's allowed me to use his name any way I want, but he will not write anything for our program. And there are a list of very high-level people that won't even allow me to use their names, even though they're all retired and getting old and what have you, going to die soon. The reason for that is, if you look at poor Nancy Reagan, when it was admitted that she was interested in astrology, the media slaughtered her, just clobbered her for that. So I didn't want to out Bill Cohen at all unless he gave me permission.
So you're working with these elected officials, and they have that kind of pressure. The public is scrutinizing everything they did. Are you involved in some kind of satanic kind of cult kind of thing over there?
Exactly.
Are you involved in a boondoggle kind of crazy thing? So there's a lot of stuff going on.
For example, I had a rather substantial contract with the United States Air Force. All right. And an official in the hierarchy of the United States Air Force, and I won't name him, said, and this is an exact quote, I believe in ESP. It is the work of the devil. Kill that program. And they came and took our money back.
Right.
Furthermore, Dale Graff, who was then working as a civilian for Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, one of our contract monitors, he had been given an award for excellence in remote viewing intelligence gathering by the Air Force and gave him a sabbatical. When that statement was made by the senior official within the Air Force, they took his sabbatical back. He was so pissed off, he quit the Air Force as a civilian and went to work for DIA. Mm. So that's kind of a milieu. Now, right. I have to give credit to my wife, Diane Jeanette, on this issue. I said, you know, in Russia, it's just the opposite. The Russians love their senior people to be associated with this program. And they're religious, too. They're, you know, the Eastern Orthodox Church, the Russian Orthodox Church. It turns out what she thought was a way to blame the Protestant Reformation in the following sense. The Reformation basically was the origin of the fact that we in the West and Western religions have taken mysticism out of the practice of religion for the most part. Even the Catholics don't do it very much anymore. The Anglicans still have some mysticism. But you go to Russia and you go through any of those churches, they're 90% mysticism. So they are comfortable with, and the mysticism has its origin in shamanism in Central Asia. And that is kind of a hand-waving explanation why it's safe for senior Soviet officials, former Soviet officials, to admit that they are involved in this program and even wanted to be part of it, even though they weren't, whereas just the opposite is true here in this country. So that's why we had to protect Cohen. So when Angela and I met him in his office, he agreed to write a lengthy letter in support of our work, and that is it contained in all four of these volumes, his support of our work.
Excellent. And I love that little bit about the mysticism. Ed, in terms of the website, I found you through your website. Is that the best place for people to find out information about you, keep up with what you're doing?
Yeah, eventually. I just took down a very old website that had been around for 20 years, and I'm just doing it with a new technology for me, WordPress. So it's alive, but not great at the moment. So bear with me. There'll be videos and protocols and all kinds of good stuff there. It's basically under construction, and so people can watch how I screw it up.
Okay, and that URL?
It's www. L as in Lima, F as in Foxtrot, R as in Romeo, LFR.org.
LFR.org. Great. Well, we'll certainly have a link to it in the show. Ed, it's been absolutely fantastic having you on the show. You are so much a part of this really important history, and I think your ideas on this are extremely important. We don't have to agree to agree that we need to get everything you're thinking out there into the record, onto the table, and consider it.
Well, I apologize for getting frustrated with you because you were boring down on something of which I know very little or even care very little about. And I know it's important to you. That doesn't mean you're wrong and I'm right. It's just a difference of view. That's all.
No apology needed. It's just spent, you know, I got 50 or 60 shows on it. So I got a lot of stuff there to kind of get out. So it's all good, as they say. Ed, again, thank you so much for being on the show.
You're most welcome, Alex. Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Well, thanks again to Dr. Ed May for joining me today on Skeptico. I'm glad we're able to end the interview with such pleasantries and on what seemed like good terms. I have to say that's not how it really ended. The next day, Ed sent me an email saying, you know, gee, I didn't really think that went very well. Why don't we do a redo? Just trash that whole thing and we'll do it over. Now, I've run into this before from people who say a bunch of stuff and then think about it later and don't quite like what they said. And my response was my usual response, which was, I'm happy to have you come back on. I'm happy to have you clarify, elaborate, correct anything you said, but I'm really not inclined to scrap that first interview. Well, that really pissed him off again, and he started calling me all these names and making all these threats and doing all this other crazy stuff. Now, one thing I mentioned I wanted to update you on is my conversation with Dr. Dean Radin following this interview. You'll recall that during the interview, Ed said, I'm sad to report that Radin's idea of consciousness and wave functions is demonstrably inconsistent with 80 years worth of experiment and theory. So I asked Dean. And now, Dean, if you don't know Dean Radin, he's not only top-notch, really knows his stuff, but he's one of the kinder and nicer people you'll meet in this field. So he's never going to bash anyone. But what he said in a very polite way is a couple of things that are probably obvious to most of you skeptical listeners. First is that Ed presupposes that he knows what consciousness is, which is a dangerous assumption given that that's what we're really trying to answer in the first place. But the other mistake he makes, and it irks me because all these materialists kind of totally distort the history of quantum physics, and a lot of times they're physicists, like Ed May is a physicist, or you remember Dr. Sean Carroll was on, Harvard physicist, and they just tell a history of quantum physics that's just demonstrably wrong. I mean, in this case, what Dean points out and what many of you will know is that Dean's experiment set up to see if an individual, a meditator, can collapse the wave function is a direct test of the von Neumann interpretation of quantum physics. John von Neumann, He counts, he matters, but it's also consistent with what Niels Bohr and Schrodinger believed, that, hey, there's something mystical going on here, that consciousness is necessary to understand quantum physics. If I remember correctly, Max Planck also has a famous quote out there that consciousness is at the heart of all this. The point being not that one of those people are right or wrong, but to suggest that, oh, this is case closed, this isn't even an issue in quantum physics, whether human consciousness collapses the wave function, is just, to borrow Ed's phrase, demonstrably inconsistent with what's been going on for 80 years. So I have one question that I'll tee up from this interview, one of many that I could tee up, and I hope we explore a lot more questions in the forum. But the one question I tee up is, what do you make of Ed's retrocausation explanation for near-death experience? And the broader question is, why do these guys fumble so badly on the near-death experience research? As I tried to lay out in this interview, to me, it's basic. You know, we're fighting over psi, we're fighting over does mind equal brain. The near-death experience stuff is the natural place you go because now, medically, physiologically, we have an understanding of what's going on in the brain, that the brain is not there. So why wouldn't you jump right into that to answer this question? But instead, they seem to engage in all these apologetics to kind of harmonize it with what they think they believe. Ah, there I am, overlaying my opinion on this. But it's hard to resist doing that after all these shows. But anyways, I'm open to other opinions. I'm open to, even if it pisses you off what I'm saying, I'm open to hearing your point of view. And of course, the place to do that is through the Skeptical website at skeptiko.com. From there, you can leave a comment directly or jump on over to the forum where I'm sure we'll have a lively discussion on this interview. Well, I have a number of interesting shows coming up, and I certainly hope you stay with me for all of those. I appreciate you joining me for this one and for being part of this Skeptico show. So until next time, take care and bye for now.